once we understand what's going on, what are the causes at play, what are the strengths that we see there, then to me, coaching oftentimes can be relevant and become part of a solution. Typically, it's going to be more than just coaching. There's going to be other supports in place and connections to things going on in the school or district, again, to provide it that foundation and that home so that it exists within the larger work and priorities of the organization. But again, at the very start, when we're just getting our feet wet and trying to see the situation with fresh eyes, we do, I will acknowledge, at least in my own practice, I try, even though if I know coaching is likely part of my solution, I try to take a step back for a second and see the situation afresh without a solution in mind. And that's just the first step. And then as we understand more and more, we go, okay, well, let's think about coaching in this situation. How would it work? Would it have the support? Would it have the impact that matches the need that we've heard from the people we're working with?
I'm Jim Knight, co-founder of the Instructional Coaching Group, and you're listening to Coaching Conversations, where I talk with coaching experts from around the world so that all of us can learn better ways to make an unmistakably positive impact on the people around us.
Hello, listeners. It's ICG consultant Jessica Wise, and I want to invite you to join Jim Knight and the Instructional Coaching Group team at this year's Teaching, Learning, Coaching Conference in New Orleans. If you are looking to learn, practice, reflect, and grow your craft, the TLC conference is the place to be. Whether you join us in person or online, you'll experience meaningful keynotes, powerful breakouts, and time to network and invest in human connection with like-minded educators. Join us October 27th through the 29th as we gather to empower passionate educators to keep kids first. Visit instructionalcoaching.com/TLC-2024. I hope to see you there.
So I'm sitting down with James Marshall, the author of this book, Right from the Start. And I'm going to ask Jim to tell us a bit about himself, professor at University of San Diego State University, the number one education school in the state of California, which is a population of about three times Australia. So that's pretty huge. You've published over 200 articles, 250 program evaluations, and I think you can make the case that he's the world's leading expert on implementing programs in schools. So I'm super, and I have to tell you, I picked you to come to this interview for selfish reasons, because I'm very interested in implementing coaching in schools. I feel it's an area we have to get much better at. I think we're developing what we call impact coaching system, which is about creating a system within schools to provide support. We see coaching implemented all over the place. In fact, I just wrote an article on what I call nominal implementation for ed leadership. And so I'm super thrilled you're here and grateful for the time. So I'm excited to learn from you today, Jim.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here, excited for the conversation.
You also have a whole bunch of my friends or your friends. So Doug Fisher, I've had the pleasure of hanging out with him quite a bit. And then John Hattie, I wrote an article for John on Instructional Coaching and Visible Learning. Peter DeWitt used to actually be a consultant sharing our ideas. And I was actually a little offended that I didn't get to write a little blurb inside your book. I thought, how did I get missed with all these friends of mine in here? So
I got an opportunity for you later today, then. You're going to wish maybe you'd never said that. But if a new book is coming out, and we get to talk about that later. But many an opportunity for you to comment.
Right. Well, I'm excited. So first off, just to set the stage, I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about your journey. How did you come to focus on this particular topic and write so much about the idea of implementation? What's the journey you took to get here?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. I look back and I think about my formative years and all the different programs that my parents typically, or maybe my own impetus at times, put me through. And it's so easy now to connect the dots to who I became. And I think that's true for all of us. Programs change our lives, not only in ways that influence who we become, but who we don't become. I'm fond of saying, you know, the ballroom dance program didn't take. So I'm not a ballroom dancer. But I look at those formative experiences, and I know that as we look at the kids in our schools, they're having those experiences that will shape who they become as we design professional learning, professional supports. I run one of the largest, if not the largest, doctoral programs in the California State University. We are changing lives through these programs, and we've got to do them right, and we want to do them with predictable results. So I actually have made a career out of evaluating all different kinds of learning programs because with data and a better understanding of what we're doing, we increase our chance of having positive, predictable results. And that's really the throughput in all of the work I do, is getting it right early so that when we start implementing, the right things happen and the results that we've targeted are actually more likely to come about.
Well, I love the title. It's a nice little pun, you know. It's right from the start, but we have to do it right. It's right from the start as well. So, and I'm excited to, I'm already thinking I've got to be careful to start right in the right way, right at the start, as we work on this idea of impact coaching systems. But just to set the stage, you talk about implementing programs and initiatives. Could you distinguish between those two things? Is there any need to even distinguish? Can we just use the terms interchangeably?
So the answer to your question is yes. And I actually kind of play both sides of the fence there, because I think we as educators have come into our world talking a lot about programs. However, I also see an evolution of the language to initiative. So I took the opportunity in this book to draw a bit of a parallel, although there's much overlap. To me, an initiative is what we should be doing. They are carefully planned, carefully situated in our schools and district, initiatives that systemically change state of being. Programs, to me, historically, could be that. But they also could be something, for instance, the superintendent saw at a conference and thought was great. He said, now we're going to all do this. So to me, a program is more often just kind of off to the side, something standalone and unique, whereas an initiative is embedded truly in the organization and the people therein, and really designed to make an impact. And I argue we should be doing more initiatives, way more initiatives than programs. So I do use the words interchangeably, but to me, initiative, I use an iceberg model in the book. Mm-hmm. Initiative has that deep under the water sort of root, so it is less likely to be rocked by the waves during the implementation.
So coaching would more likely be referred to as an initiative than a program.
I firmly believe a successful coaching program is embedded within the organization and dependent on a number of other things to be successful.
So you organize the book in three sections: needs assessment, designing and launching the initiative, and then implementation to action. And I thought I'd organize our conversation around those three areas. Tell me a bit about first why you think needs assessments are important.
Oh, that is the million-dollar question. I love needs assessment. And as I said a moment ago, I've done so many program evaluations. I wish I had done as many needs assessments. Without needs assessment, I would retitle the book possibly right from the start, or we'll see if we guessed it right from the start.
Maybe okay.
Yeah, exactly. Needs assessment is what we do at the beginning, and I use this term in the book too, to get smart about what's happening, the current state. And needs assessment is about needs. It's about things that aren't. But I argue it's just as much about things that are. If we're going to situate and plan for change, we need to know where the strengths lie, because oftentimes the best way to fill a gap is to build on a strength. And so needs assessment is an intentional action of taking a bit of time to step back from whatever challenge or opportunity we're facing and dedicate ourselves to truly understanding it by standing in the shoes of the people involved. We're not planning just based on what we think we know, but we're taking the time, be it a few hours, a few days, a few weeks, to intentionally dedicate ourselves to becoming smarter about what's going on So again, we're increasing the chances of whatever we design initiative-wise taking hold and having an impact.
And I hear you saying it's not just this is what we're not doing, but it's also these are the things we're doing well.
I have found over the course of my career, even I have changed my deficit lens. We're so used to, you know, a gap being the difference between what is and what we want. And so often I noticed in my early career, I was laser-like focused on uncovering all the gaps to the point where I was missing some of the good things happening and the strengths. And oftentimes when we're trying to solve a problem or realize an opportunity, it is those strengths that we can pull in and use as part of the change process. And obviously implementation is in big way a change initiative.
So what would, I'm going to just say this now, but I could say it at the start of every question. There's so much in your book about this that we're only going to be able to touch on the surface. But what would you say, these are some essential things that have to be in place for an effective needs assessment?
Yeah, I would argue, and I do in the book, you know, a lot of times people gristle at the idea of dedicating time to a needs assessment. It's like, well, let's just get this show on the road, you know, make some PowerPoint slides, set up some coaching appointments, whatever it is. And so needs assessment can often in an organization be seen as lack of doing something. It's like, we don't want studying, we want doing. And yet, if the doing is going to be successful, I argue that the studying, if that's what we want to call it, is all but requisite. So I think barriers to doing needs assessment are kind of the lack of awareness and understanding around how critical it is. Another is getting your hands on actionable data. The quickest way to do needs assessment is to leverage data that's already out there. And so we have to be good at not only finding that, but I would argue we have to get good at being creative in finding pockets of evidence and data out there that might not be, let's say, you know, controlled studies that are clinically reliable, but a little accurate data is better than not consulting any data at all. And so those are some of the things that get in the way. I did a study about 8 years ago about barriers to program evaluation. And I would argue that some of these barriers are the same, that oftentimes the data exists all over the school or district, and it doesn't all come together. You have to do that work. You know, it's like 12 spreadsheets to understand something. And I think things have gotten better in that way. But I still think we've got a ways to go. And then the other thing I have to say is people don't expect it. People don't know how important it is. And that's one of the reasons why a third of the book is dedicated to it, because I just feel it's critical. And I've seen that when I'm contracted to do a program evaluation and a needs assessment didn't occur, it often is obvious in the lack of outcomes or specificity of outcomes and in the implementation plan. So all of those reasons, I think, make needs assessment critical, yet still something that is not done as often as it should be.
Well, you're making me think of two things. First off, I've never heard that term, actionable data. I know Chris Argyris's ideas about actionable knowledge, and I use that term frequently to talk about taking books and taking the ideas and making them ones we can use, translating concepts into behavior. But what's actionable data? I can come up with my own definition, but I love the term, and I'd love to hear what you think it is.
Well, actionable data to me is any data that is helping you better understand a situation. So often as leaders, we are short on time to do anything and everything. And so I think of actionable data as data that comes in that gives me additional insight into a situation where I am thinking about taking some sort of action. So it's data that informs the actions that I'm considering. It may confirm my beliefs, and more often than not, it extends them, and sometimes it flies in the face of what I think or I've been told. So yeah, that's kind of how I look at it.
Well, it's useful because it can help you see things you wouldn't ordinarily see. When you bring a particular interpretive lens to whatever it is you're looking at, let's say a simple thing like praise versus corrections in the classroom, that simple form of data, when you look for that, you'll see things you don't otherwise see. And it's the same thing, same way you interpret a text or whatever it might be. The other thing that I want to get out, I might as well do it now, is in my opinion, and this is kind of my article for ASCD on nominal implementation, in my opinion, in education, particularly in the United States, that I, not to say it's not elsewhere, but I don't know it to be true elsewhere. I don't know it as well as the rest of the world, but we're suffering a plague of nominal implementation. People say we're doing PLCs, but they're not structured. People aren't trained to do it. We're doing coaching, but the coaches aren't actually doing any coaching. We're doing positive behavior supports, but it's only sort of partially implemented and they get started and it kind of goes off the wayside. Is that your read of how things are happening in the world of education in the U.S. too? Am I missing the boat, or do you think that's an accurate picture?
I do not disagree with your typification, acknowledging it is obviously, I think you would too, a generalization.
Right.
Can find pockets of excellence out there where things truly are being implemented, both with rigor and success. But I do agree with you. I think in part, that's one of the reasons why I advocate use of the word initiative, because to me, that's more rigorous, more defined. As we both know, if things aren't defined, people will quickly rise to the occasion, which is whatever happens, happens. And so I do agree. Also, the lack of outcomes being defined, so we all have something unifying us towards, in a direction, towards a destination, I think, again, creates this space for very, well, I like your term, nominal implementation. I wrote an article back in the early 2000s called "The Unimplemented Program Yields Few Results." And it actually is untrue when you think about it. It just yields all the results, basically, of a needs assessment, why the program's not working.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do agree that when things go wrong in implementation, and I think the part of going wrong is either inconsistent implementation or implementation that falls short of what's needed, it's often due either to lack of good definition on the front end or all those systemic elements that support an initiative's life within a school or a district.
Hi, everyone. It's ICG consultant Jessica Wise, host of the Coaching Questions on the Coaching Conversations podcast with Jim Knight. Here to talk about our virtual workshop titled System Support, What Administrators Need to Know. We know that the impact coaches have is directly related to how effectively they are supported or not supported by their administrators. For that reason, it is crucial that administrators participate in professional development that clarifies what coaches do and how they can be supported. Our virtual workshop, System Support, we'll provide administrators with everything they need to know about instructional coaching. Join us to learn about the partnership principles that guide coaches' interactions with teachers, the 6 specific actions administrators can take to support coaches effectively, the 5 simple truths of helping, and more. Join us or learn more by visiting instructionalcoaching.com.
Yeah, we'll come back to that when we talk about someone who leads the program and how the system supports or inhibits that. But I did want to ask you one last question, since this is coaching we're talking about. What would be some elements of an effective needs assessment for coaching?
I love this question. And I was thinking about it just the other day. Coaching is such a powerful solution, but it is a solution, just like, say, sending people to time and place bound professional learning sort of opportunity. So from my perspective and in the work I do, the needs assessment for coaching really wouldn't start off any differently. We'd take a giant step back and really examine the opportunity or the challenge we're facing. And as I've said earlier, dedicate time to getting smart about that. Once we understand what's going on, what are the causes at play, what are the strengths that we see there, then to me, coaching oftentimes can be relevant and become part of a solution. Typically, it's going to be more than just coaching. There's going to be other supports in place and connections to things going on in the school or district. Again, to provide it that foundation and that home so that it exists within the larger work and priorities of the organization. But again, at the very start, when we're just getting our feet wet and trying to see the situation with fresh eyes, we do, I will acknowledge, at least in my own practice, I try, even though if I know coaching is likely part of my solution, I try to take a step back for a second and see the situation afresh without a solution in mind. And that's just the first step. And then as we understand more and more, we go, okay, well, let's think about coaching in this situation. How would it work? Would it have the support? Would it have the impact that matches the need that we've heard from the people we're working with?
So it's kind of, where are we now? Taking account of the positive resources that exist, but also the needs. Where do we want to get to? And how are we going to get there? And how does coaching help us get there? I have to put it in kind of a pinhead way, but that seems like the idea.
You're absolutely right. And I'm sure you know, and your experience in coaching is vast, but you also know that it often exists within a system of other solutions. For instance, if the folks we're working with lack skills and knowledge foundationally, we need to do some professional learning around that first. And coaching in those kind of situations can be the most awesome bridge to practice and then perfection of that learning. So that's just one example of how different elements can come together. For experienced people, a coaching program in and of itself, that may be the perfect solution based on what the needs are and where we're where we've said we want to go.
So the second part of your book is designing and launching the initiative, not the program, the initiative. So what are some crucial elements to consider when you are launching an initiative?
At the risk of sounding like a broken record, I think, you know, honestly, it goes back to needs assessment. Mm-hmm. Like, the crucial elements are surfaced during that process, what we need to pay attention to. But I make a really strong argument in the book, and the whole book itself reflects this, that it's a systemic effort. And so we need to understand all the components of what the initiative is going to involve, and then embedded within the larger system so that it works. The initiatives that go wrong often have little, if any, connection to the priorities of the school or the district, or they have no value to the people they engage. So have the teachers, the educators been involved in the design? Do they see the need? And so just getting that buy-in, both from the people you rely on to support the initiative as well as the people who the initiative is serving, that buy-in from, you could say, top to bottom, equally important at all levels. And then last, I'd just say, and we touched on this earlier, but we know in today's education space, connecting this work to established strengths will take us further faster, typically. And I believe that is also a crucial element to consider.
Thinking about further faster, I think that's a good name for the next book. I like that, as a book title. So you talk about a logic model, and it's a term I've heard a lot. I wonder if you could tell me what we mean by a logic model and how that fits into the whole idea of planning an initiative.
I would love to. Logic models are often met by professionals who are unfamiliar with hesitation, and I've even seen hostility. I mean, in like funded programs, planning meetings that say the Department of Ed hosts, because they seem complicated. But essentially what a logic model does and is just a roadmap of your initiative. And it, you know, in three simple columns, to perhaps oversimplify, we talk about what are all the resources we need to do this? What are we going to do? And what do we expect to happen as a result of doing it? I think of a logic model, and I argue it's both a roadmap and a placemat. It's something you establish early on. It's a roadmap because it gives you the pathway of the initiative from conception through implementation to expected outcomes and impact. But I also say it's a placemat because it's a great consensus tool to put on the table in front of everybody involved with at regular intervals to make sure no pun intended, we're all on the same page. And we have a shared definition of the initiative and its components, and this is what we're working towards. When I'm an evaluator brought in from the outside to certainly validate a program, determine its impact, if somebody hands me a logic model, I know this initiative has been carefully planned, and I immediately know, at least initially, where as evaluator of what I'm going to go look for in terms of measuring implementation, and then what outcomes I should expect if the initiative is successful to be producing. So I just argue it's worth the time. You may be familiar also with the tool, the theory of action tool. The two share some common attributes, but the whole idea is, what is the logic behind us expecting these outcomes? You know, again, not by chance, but right from the start, predictable.
I want to come back to that when we get into the third section of the book, but you talk about the importance of a program director, which is something I really believe in. And with respect to coaching, if someone doesn't own the initiative, I'm not confident it's going to happen. Tell us about why you think that's important and kind of what a program director might be responsible for.
Yeah, I see this in the program evaluation work I do with districts all the time. When there's a dedicated program leader, I would say I can more count on a rigorous and high quality implementation. There's somebody who's responsible for it. It's not one of these situations, well, you know, everybody's doing this, so, you know, it's just going to happen. But no, there's ultimately somebody who's overseeing it. When we think about the concept of continuous monitoring and continuous improvement, I think of the program leader as key to that. Yes, getting it off the ground is an accomplishment in and of itself. But the day-to-day oversight and watching of the initiative and caring about it, the champion for the initiative, those are all key to this individual's work. And I think the last thing I would just observe about a program leader is, and I mentioned this earlier, but initiatives are change. No two ways about it. And we all know for change to be successful, somebody has to be behind that change, leading it, you know, pushing at times, pulling at times, advocating up and down the organization. And so I think those are all reasons why. And actually, sorry, one more thing that comes to mind. We know for most initiatives, and this is a broad overgeneralization, but it takes years to get it in place, running well, and achieving long-term outcomes. So having a leader oversee it with that kind of consistency to stay the course to the point of true impact, I think that's also key.
I couldn't agree more. That is exactly what we've seen with our work, for reasons we'll go into in a second. But what would you say would be the characteristics of an effective program director?
Yeah, I you know, again, I think I go back to, they've got to be a good champion for the project. They've got to be good at using data to promote the initiative and sustain the interest of higher-ups in terms of keeping it in place, proving its value again and again and again, because we know how these things work in school districts. Somebody who understands what I call, I wasn't the first person, but what's called the white space in the organization. It's the space in the org chart between the boxes where the work really gets done. Somebody who has that systems perspective and knows tacitly how things run in the district and can be both an advocate and a problem solver as they go through. I think of the program leaders. I evaluate a Maker program initiative right now that's funded by National Science Foundation. And I think of these program leaders who not only are training people to implement the program, but they're also going to Walmart to get, you know, pieces of plastic that they need for the Maker initiative, and dealing with only, they can only buy it if they get the superintendent's credit card. I mean, it's just these systems that keep us from being successful implementing things. This person truly is a problem solver operating at all levels, but they can do that because they're dedicated to the initiative, and a leader is in place.
Now, as I was reading about this, I was reminded of Jim Collins' idea of ambition and humility. They're driven for change, sort of relentless in pursuit of change, but deeply responsive to the people of others. When things go wrong, they take the blame. When things go well, they share the wealth. They shine the light on other people. So I think those, and we found in looking at leaders of coaching programs, even in coaches, is that if the coach is ambitious for change, but not responsive and not humble, that pushy, it turns people off. And if they're humble and responsive, but they're not ambitious for change, not much happens. You really need the two things, that sort of drive, reliability, intent, focus on moving forward, and that respectful response to the people you work with.
I love that dichotomy. And I think we both could picture, and your listeners as well, those people in schools and districts where they're really good at pushing for what they want. And in doing so, politically, perhaps, they don't have the skills. And so the push never gets anywhere. But then you think of somebody who has that dichotomy you just so perfectly described, and they're able to push while also knowing where and when to push and how much. And I think that is a skill that comes through experience, perhaps, and is also at least in part innate.
So what I'd like to tell you sort of how I see a program director for coaching work, and then you tell me what I've missed. So
fantastic. I love it.
Because our focus is primary. Well, I'll just lay it all out. So we see seven success factors for instructional coaching. Three of them are about who you are. What are my beliefs? You know, what are the principles that guide my action, my theory of action, I guess you could say. My way of being is really how we would put it. What are my skills? How do I communicate? How do I listen, ask questions? And then thirdly, how do I lead myself and lead others? And that ambition and humility would be one part of leadership, but also I'm clear on my purpose. I use my time effectively. Those would be who I am. Second part is, what do I do? Well, you need some kind of coaching cycle, a conversational framework to help you move from getting a clear picture of reality, which would be your needs assessment, to setting a goal. In fact, I think what we call the impact cycle applies for initiative change too. But then if you're going to set a goal, you need to be able to gather data. You need to know, we would look at a student engagement, student achievement, maybe well-being measures as well, but you set goals. And then you need to get to those goals. You had to have a pathway to take you there. And so that's what we call an instructional playbook, a set of teaching practices to take you there. And for the record, I did the first instructional playbook ideas, but
nice.
I think, but it's caught on pretty widely. So first part is who I am. Second part is what I do. The third part is where I work. And I need to have time to be a coach. There has to be widespread understanding of what coaches do. There has to be admin support. So I would see a coaching director being behind the implementation of all seven of those things. They're helping people reflect on their behavior and setting up learning opportunities for them to think about their beliefs. They're engaged in what we call real play activities, because something dies inside of you when you hear role play. But real play, we can get away with that. So role play, to practice the way you ask questions, the way you listen. And then they're meeting with people to discuss how they're moving through the cycle. They're building playbooks collectively with the coaches. They're helping them practice and gather data. And then they're meeting with the leaders in the schools to make sure the system is supporting coaching. Now, what else would you add to that list? I'm sure there are things you'd put on there in addition to that.
You know, I'm not sure that I would. And here's what I'll say, if I just kind of mirror back. To me, somebody leading a coaching initiative, as I think through, and I don't think it's that different from what I've raised, but I see the champion role within, as the program leader and the coaching initiative leader within the school or the district. I see in what you said, the tactical piece, which is the implementing, the monitoring, the evaluation, the alignment to the plan. I also see what I call the adjusting along the way. You know, a program leader has to be inherently flexible, but only in the right ways. And so discerning where you can and can't be flexible in terms of implementing something, including coaching, I think is key. And then last but not least, as I think we've agreed, you know, these folks are change agents, and so they need to have the dispositions to make these relationships with people and facilitate their change, even when the going gets tough. And having those tough conversations, I know is key to any of the coaching I do at the university with our students who are all city school leaders, and what happens in the field for sure.
Well, that brings me to the last part, which is from implementation to action. And so the first thing I think, just to set the stage, is the logic model is not carved in stone. Is that fair to say?
Very fair to say. I've yet to meet the perfect implementation, you know, and as we joke around about, it's like, you know, the logic model should be drawn with a pencil, not a pen, because you will learn things and you will change. And if you don't, I would argue you're probably not collecting enough data and reflecting enough, because there's always room to evolve an initiative based on when program meets world, things unexpected happen. So yes, it can change and it should.
What's that Mike Tyson quote? Everything is going great until you get punched in the face or whatever. Like, that's kind of the deal. So how would you suggest schools go about monitoring impact? And maybe that question can only be answered if you know what the actual initiative is, but are there sort of general principles to keep in mind?
I do believe there are, and one of them is exactly what you said. You know, part of how you go about it is how you've defined your implementation. So by having measurable touchstones and defined elements of an initiative, you can monitor it. If they're not defined, if they're fuzzy, you all know them when you see them. So that would be one sort of tenet, I think, of this work. Jody Spirow, formerly of the Wallace Organization, now advisor of Learning Forward, she talks about early wins. And I like her terminology. It's something I've known for a long time, but I've never really conceptualized it the way she does. But she says, you know, early on with any change initiative, you should have easily attainable but overt defined accomplishments. And I think of it as, you know, if I'm trying to get a snowball rolling down the hill, I got to like get a little bit of momentum and build on it. And I want to keep going and going. So I think early wins, which is something I suggest you do define for every initiative. That's one thing. Using data that's already there whenever possible. I think if you can align that and it's reliable data against the initiative, I think that is key to monitoring impact. Embedding it in the culture, making monitoring of the initiative something we talk about regularly. How's it going? I think is key. And then part and parcel of that is something I firmly believe. You know, monitoring impact is not something we do to the participants. It's something we do with them. And so inviting their participation, not only to be doing the initiative, but be part of its evaluation and our reflection, I think those are all best practice within this space.
So much of what you're saying is the way we would approach coaching. So we talk about the power of, we use quick wins, but early wins is probably a nicer term. But we feel that you, and I don't know if we're explicit enough about this, as I'm talking to you, I think we may need to be a little more precise about exactly what will the first wins be. Because those early wins, as you call them, what they show is, you know, actually my actions are making a difference. It builds agency. I'm not helpless because I'm doing things and it's changing things. And then once you've got that going, Rosabeth Moss Kanter would talk about building momentum. Well, one change happened, let's build some more. I suppose it even extends out to students. Students have some successes and they start to build some confidence and it grows and it grows and it grows and you move forward. Anything else you'd like to say about the elements of a successful evaluation plan?
I think I'd just go back to to the beginning of our conversation and, you know, kind of draw the two halves together. To me, needs assessment and program evaluation are like yin and yang.
Mm-hmm.
Needs assessment helps you know what's happening and define a better state so that you know where you're going. like not anywhere will do. You know where you're headed. Program evaluation helps you confirm that you are on the way or have gotten at least part of the way there, or all the way there even. But program evaluation is almost, in a way, a needs assessment all over again, because done well, it can help you circle back and continuously adjust the initiative in these iterative cycles of continuous improvement. So I think, you know, for an evaluation, obviously outcomes are everything. We should all be united around where we're headed and how we're going to get there. Program evaluation should pay attention both to accomplishments in implementing the program and the impact they're having short and long term. My evaluation plans do define early wins, because especially when you're an external evaluator, sometimes you're not the most popular person to show up on the scene because of, frankly, bad connotations with the term evaluation, which almost immediately is always thought of as personnel evaluation rather than program evaluation. We're looking at the initiative here. So those are some of the things I think of when I think about program evaluation. To me, it should be very participatory. And again, it's not something being done to folks, but as a partner at the table, when I'm doing evaluation, my job is to help them see their initiative clearly, help them celebrate their accomplishments while also shining light on things that are opportunities to continue to improve the initiative, again, towards positive, predictable results.
Well, it's organizational learning. You know, as a team, as a group, as a community, we're coming together, we're learning, and learning is, you know, fundamental to fulfilling life. So the work of you're describing of high quality implementation of initiatives or programs, it really cuts to the heart of why we do this work. Where it doesn't work is when you feel you're not heard, or when you're bullied by the data, or it's poorly implemented and you're blamed for the lack of implementation, or the system doesn't support quality implementation. There's all kinds of reasons why it might not work. But when it's done well, it should actually build efficacy. It should help people feel better about what they do, because they're learning as a team and they're learning as individuals. So I'm thrilled. I've learned so much from the conversation. But what's this other project I'm going to hear about? You said you had another project.
Yeah, so I have a second book that is in production right now. It'll be out just before summer. And it is called Fixing Educational Initiatives in Crisis, 24 Go-To Strategies. And I will admit that my phone rings more often because somebody's in crisis with the initiative than it does for, can you come help us do needs assessment or program evaluation, which are historically where I get involved. So I've defined 6 different types of commonly encountered crises, everything from failure to get smart to attention span issues, which relates to buy-in, continued support, through things like sustaining and scaling type crises. And so this book is meant to be picked up at time of crisis to assess the kinds of crisis or crises you face and offer some quick fix solutions to guide you in thinking about course correction. I joke with the editor, Tanya Gans, who I absolutely love at Corwin. I joke with her that this is probably the first book I should have wrote, because I feel like this is the one that people are going to be like, yes, I need that. And then hopefully with that guidance and some success there, they'll say, right from the start, now this next initiative, I'm going to avoid crisis by doing it right from the start, step by step. So I'm super excited about that book. You know, everybody loves a good crisis. Everybody loves getting of a good crisis even more.
Hey, I think they need right from the start, if you ask me. I think they need that one right from the start, too. But sign me up. I want to be involved if I can read or say anything about it. I've learned so much. This has been exactly the conversation I was hoping for. So I'm very grateful, Jim, and good luck with the new book. But I hope people read right from the start. I think it's essential. It's essential for us to have high-quality implementation. We have great ideas. but they are not great if they aren't implemented effectively. And you give us the ways to do it, so I'm grateful. Thanks.
Absolutely. And thank you for the time. And I love the connections and application to coaching here. And I think that's a real helpful touch point because leaders arguably are coaches. And I appreciate you making some of these ideas even more clear in my own head. So great time together.
Great. Well, hopefully the first of many conversations.
Wonderful.
Thanks.